off. And so just be aware of that. If you come, no one else will be here. I mentioned just a few moments ago just a little bit about the setting of what we're talking about tonight. We're still in that period of Israel's history where Ahaz is on the throne. The Assyrians are beginning to expand down into this particular part of the world. Ahaz is trying to strike a deal with the Assyrian king to protect him from these other two kings that are living very close to him. One actually being the king Pekah, the king of Israel, and also Aram or Syria, that particular king who had that had already joined together in attempts of repelling the Assyrians from coming down, and they wanted Ahaz to be a part of that. Now, Ahaz was not a good king. He was not a godly king. As a matter of fact, according to 2 Chronicles chapter 16, I think, if I remember, there's a brief chapter that kind of deals with Ahaz. And it points out that he was guilty of making one of his children pass through the fire. What does that mean? That means child sacrifice. And God does not respond well to the shedding of innocent blood. Always remember that. And so Ahaz is really not given good marks at all. He was a king that was anything. He was not anything like he should have been. His son Hezekiah, who will succeed him at the throne or on the throne, did serve God well compared to the kings, other kings. Now, we were in chapter 9 last time. We're going to step over chapter 10 simply because we're going to be continuing with some of the same themes that we've already looked at. So in hopes of not being redundant, we're going to move on to chapter 11. Now, chapter 11 is a chapter, you just imagine, you are living in a country, Judah, with a king like Ahaz. One, he's a godless, a reprobate king. He was not godly in any sense of the word. Because of that, you also will find that life was somewhat challenging. Challenging because in order to by favor with the Assyrians, Ahaz was paying tribute to him. In other words, he was paying for protection, which would show itself later as being a fool's errand. And then also, you're dealing with these hostile threats of people living much closer to you than the Assyrians. So there's a lot of stuff going on there, and a lot of anxiety. It may not be today or tomorrow or this year, but eventually you're going to have to deal with these Assyrians. They're coming. And you're going to run out of gold and silver, robbing the house of God in order to give them what, you know, paying tribute. You're going to run out of those things. And then what's going to happen? And so you have those kind of issues going on. So, chapter 11, in the midst of that, you're going to see a different Davidic king. Not Ahaz, but one very unlike Ahaz is going to be prophesied. As a matter of fact, his reign is even going to be described in ways that are almost the reversal of the curse that you find in Genesis. That king's coming. We don't know when. We don't know who. Other than he is coming, we know that he's going to be a descendant of David. But we don't know a lot else. But what Isaiah is giving us, and them, of course, is the prospect of this righteous king coming. And if you're living under the reign of a very unrighteous king, that would be a very, very hopeful statement. So we're going to be looking at that. As a matter of fact, we're going to be, well, we'll get to some of the particulars in a moment. It begins this way. Then a shoot will spring from the stem or the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. Okay, pause right there. This is an interesting observation that you'll find in Jerusalem and in Judea. That one of the trees that are the most valuable are, of course, the olive trees. Olive trees are quite unique in this sense. You can cut one down, but as long as the roots are still living, you will get another olive tree. Another one will grow from its stump, so there'll be a little sucker. That's what we call them where I grew up. A little sucker that will come up on it out of that, and a new tree will form. And so even today in Israel, according to those that gave us this information, they make a lot of things out of olive wood. But what happens is the tree isn't essentially killed. It gets to a place and a growth pattern just to a certain. It's no longer productive. They cut it down, let the wood dry, use the wood for various things, but then another tree will start coming out of those roots. And so you get the idea here. Then a shoot will spring from the stem or the stump of Jesse. It doesn't say David. It says Jesse. But it is pointing, of course, to the Davidic dynasty. This is going to be a descendant of David. And he's got a messianic title here. It's an easy way for us to miss it because we don't necessarily think this way. But it's the word branch. And a branch from his roots will bear fruit. This particular new tree, as it were, coming from the roots of Jesse. You see how you see the imagery here? Tree cut down, but yet it's not dead. It's still going to produce. Well, this is going to be the next thing that's going to be produced, and it's going to be this branch. He doesn't say how far in the future. But obviously it's in the future because he's speaking about in a future tense. And then he goes on in verses 2 and 3. And there's something quite unique about what's said here. And I'm going to point that out to you in just a moment. It says in verse 2, "The Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge, and the fear of the Lord." Now if you count them up, you have, which if you begin with verse 2, the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding. Then the Spirit of counsel and strength. And the Spirit of the Spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord. How many have got?
Seven.
Okay. If you want to follow with me, you can. If not, just listen. I'm going to take you to the book of Revelation. And in Revelation, I'm not going to cite all of them, but I'm going to speak of a couple of them. I want you to listen. In chapter 1, verse 4, John to the seven churches that are in Asia. Grace to you and peace from him who is, who was, and who is to come, and from the seven spirits who are before his throne. And then we go over just a little bit into chapter 4. We have another statement that can be somewhat confusing. It says in chapter 4, verse 5, "Out from the throne came flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God." Okay? Those passages, as well as this one, could speak of that God is the fullness, the completeness of the Holy Spirit. It's the number seven that's important. Are there seven Holy Spirits? Theologically, no. There's one Holy Spirit. And that one Holy Spirit is, of course, a member of the Trinity. Father, Son, and Spirit. So what does it mean when John's writing about seven spirits of God? Well, it could be its idea, because the word number seven is an important number in Hebrew numerology, which has to do with completeness. Six is the number of man, less than seven. So man is less than God. Seven is that complete number, signifying the completeness. And you'll find seven all through the Bible. You'll find that, and especially in the book of Revelation, of course, but you'll see it other places as well. 7 and 40 are very important numbers that you'll find repeated on several different times. Okay, back to this. Was John writing in reference to this passage? Is that what was in his mind when he's talking about the seven spirits of God? Was he talking about the seven statements about the Spirit that was going to rest upon this Davidic king, the branch? Well, you can kind of come to that conclusion or reject it one way or the other, but it could very well be because of, in the book of Revelation, there are so many Old Testament allusions. Not quotations, but allusions, meaning something said that is back in reference to something in the Old Testament. So this branch, at this point, was call him the branch. He's a descendant of Jesse, of course, a descendant of David. And the Holy Spirit is going to rest upon him. Verse 3 tells us more about him. Verse 3 tells us, "And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. And he will judge," "and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make decisions by his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the humble of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt around his hips, and faithfulness is the belt around his waist." Okay? So that is the description of this Davidic king that is to come. Now, one of the words, I'm trying to remember back exactly which one it is. I think it's branch. I don't remember for sure. I think it's branch. It's the same word, or the root word, that you get the word Nazareth from. It's a Nazareth, and which obviously later gets to a more of a, okay, there's a prophetic statement embedded in these words. Now, the kind of kingdom he's going to have. Well, first, let's talk about any questions, additions, comments that you have about verses 1 through 5 before we get into the next section. Now, if you were reading this in Isaiah's day, or hearing him say these things, you would struggle to understand, other than there's going to be coming a Davidic king that's going to be very unlike Ahaz. Now, from our perspective, or even the New Testament era, you can see where and whom this passage is talking about. It becomes quite clear. Quite clear. But that's the way a lot of prophecies are. They are not necessarily crystal clear until they are fulfilled. And then it goes, aha, that's what that meant. So sometimes we might find ourselves a little bit harsh for example, the disciples. Like, why didn't they have this all figured out? I mean, Jesus told them, right? Why didn't they get it? Well, because it hadn't been totally fulfilled yet. So they were struggling. They could, you know, try to get those pieces fit together. They weren't doing a very good job at doing that. And that's the way a lot of times prophecy is. Even Matthew is the one that helps us a great deal with the Emmanuel passage. Because he tells us. He tells us the meaning of it. In other passages of Scripture, we're told by New Testament writers how those passages deal with and fit with what God's prophetic plan is. You find it. You'll find it all over. One of the most delightful ones, among many, I'm just going to pick one, is the statement that God made to Abraham about Isaac when it came time to sacrifice Isaac. When God asked and required of Abraham, I want you to take your son and I want you to sacrifice him at a place that I will show you. And it ends up being later the temple is going to be built on that mountain where that took place. But if you look at the foreshadowing of it, now you wouldn't have got it then, but when you get to the New Testament era, it goes, oh, yeah, because of the way God says this to Abraham. I want to take your son, your only son, the son whom you love, and offer him as a sacrifice. If you don't hear John 3:16 packed away in that, you need to listen again. It's there. God did not have to say it that way, but he did say it that way. Because later John is going to write it that way. Okay? So that's important that you and I remember that. Anyway, we're going to move now. Now, I need to ask you, when is the next section going to be fulfilled? I want you to let that question kind of rest in your mind for just a few moments, okay? Let's look and see what it says about that. Verse 6. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf, and the young lion, and the fattened steer will be together, and a little boy will lead them, and the cow and the bear will graze, and their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox, and a nursing child will play by the hole of a cobra, and a weaned child will put his hand into a viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Okay, when? That's about the only real option that I think you can conclude is that is a millennial kingdom reference. That when Christ reigns upon this earth, the things are going to be in many ways quite different. And this is one of those ways. These predators and prey no longer fulfill those roles. Which also would suggest that the curse, to some degree, has been reversed. Now, eventually, it's going to be entirely reversed. When I say the curse, what do I mean? The fall. The result of the fall that we find in Genesis chapter 3, that's the curse. And the curse is, there's a lot wound up into that, to be sure. But as we had a VBS song a few years ago, sin messed everything up. And it does. It does. And where does sin come from? It comes from fallen creatures estranged now from the Creator and the kind of rebellion that's in their hearts. And that's going to be... And it wasn't just Adam and Eve and their descendants that were cursed. Everything was cursed. Yeah, what we call nature. The earth is cursed. Matter of fact, Paul even tells us that. That talks about this creation groans until the sons of righteousness are revealed. Until that time when there's a not just a redone earth, is what's talked about in the book of Revelation. That it's going to be a resurrected earth. You know, a new heavens and a new earth. Okay? But in the meantime, what we see around us is cursed. It's under the curse. So, you have predators, you have prey. You have beauty, but you also have ugliness. You have this mixture of all these kind of things upon this planet. The planet itself fell along with humanity. And like the song says, sin messed everything up. It sure did. But you notice the lion and the lamb and a child. A cobra will not bother a child. A child can actually put his hand down into the den of a viper. It's a poisonous snake, a venomous snake. And it won't be, there's no harm. No harm. That just is a remarkable picture that when you live in a world of chaos and cruelty, it's just so refreshing. There's going to come a time when that will no longer be. No longer be. Goes further though. About this day. On that day, what day? Let's identify the day. I mean, there's an interpretive approach here. To take that word, day. How can that word be used?
Used in like this 24-hour period.
24-hour period. That's what we normally do. That is a day. What else?
Lifetime and the day of.
In a lifetime and the day of. Okay.
Special day.
A special, an actual special day or a special period. Where it could be, it means, you know, it means both. So you can see the word day can mean several different things. And the way you're going to determine how you are to understand that is by its context. How it's used, where it's used. A lot of times words have multiple meanings, but they have multiple meanings because they have multiple usages. And we need to know how something is used to understand what it may mean in a particular text. But I'm going to back up for just a moment and affirm that I'm a young earth creationist. And I believe that the book of Genesis is accurate, talking about a day being a 24-hour period. Mm-hmm. Not epochs of time. Not millions of years. Some want to try to harmonize the idea of millions of years with the Genesis account by taking the day as a metaphor, a figure of speech. That means much longer period than that. The problem with that is, everywhere in the Old Testament that you have the word day with a number as an adjective, it means a 24-hour period. Every time. If it has a number as an adjective. So what it literally reads, you know, that God created the heavens, blah, 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 blah. It was morning. No, it was evening. It was morning. One day. That's what it's using it. That is a 24-hour period of time. That's how you understand it. Here, though, we don't have a numeric adjective. We simply have then on that day. In that period. What period we're talking about? Well, the one we just read about in verse 6 and following. That day. In that period. Not only are we going to have the animal kingdom totally changed from what we know now as being natural. Now, there's something else is going to happen. In verse 10, then on that day, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal flag for the peoples, and his glorious resting place. And his resting place will be glorious. You have the nations, the Gentiles, the Gentile world now, are going to be attracted to this king in Zion, in Israel, in Jerusalem. They're going to be attracted to him. Now remember, this is after all of the the book of Revelation reveals, the 7-year period, tribulation, that's past. Now we're in the millennial period. Okay? So things are going to be radically different. Now, having said that, the nations are going to be attracted there. It's interesting. It's interesting when you look in Genesis chapter 10 or 11, you have where they had the table of nations. Okay? Depending on how you count those, you have 70 nations mentioned there. All right? Now, some will count 72. So 72 nations. Where do these nations come from? Well, from chapter 10, you have the story of the Tower of Babel. Actually, chapter 11. Where's the chapter 10? I don't know why I can't call it right now. One of those two, you have the dividing of the people groups because of language. So people who understood each other obviously are going to come and form their own community, which later becomes a nation. Now here you've got 70. Now I want you to hang with me here, because there's some interesting things about this. Now, one of the things that Messiah is going to do is he's coming through the Jewish people, because that's what God has chosen to do. But he's going to do something else. He's going to regather the nations to himself. The temptation that Satan offered Jesus, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in just a moment, and told him, all of these are mine. I can give them to whomever I want. If you will pay homage to me, if you will bow down and worship me, I will give you all of these nations. Now, the reason why that's a temptation is because that's exactly what Jesus came to do. He came to regather the nations. So, in the table of nations there in Genesis, you have 70. Now, in Luke's gospel, you have Jesus sending out the disciples 2 by 2. Now, again, depends on how you count these and which manuscript you look at, but how many did he send out in Luke's gospel? 70. He sent out 70. Now, when you go, now I'm jumping around a little bit, but I want you to kind of follow this about the idea of the nations. When the Apostle Paul goes on his missionary journeys, okay? When the Apostle Paul goes on his missionary journeys, he goes to certain areas. The areas he goes to, or wants to go to, are the geographic areas of these 70 nations. Back in the Table of Nations. And when you count up his, you know, first, second, third missionary journey that we have record of, there's probably a fourth one. Because in the book of Romans, he tells the Roman believers there that what he wants to do, he's not been there, he hadn't seen them yet, he wants to go see them. That he might impart some gift, spiritual gift to them. But also, in addition to that, that they might help him on his journey to Spain. And why is Paul's missionary journey, why is he doing that? Well, because God is going to regather the nations to himself. You can find it in this Moses' song in Deuteronomy chapter 32. You have there that when God, divided the nations. Well, we know when that was. That was at Babel. He divided the nations. And that he himself chose to work through the people of Israel. But he is still going to regather the nation. This is important. Well, that's why the Great Commission is what it is. God is sending his people to all the people in order to gather the people back to himself. Every nation, tribe, and tongue, as it were. Every human being, or at least representative of every human nation, God is wanting to regather to himself. That's what's going on. That's what's going on. And we see hints of that all over. But this is reminding. Now remember, Isaiah is Jewish. He's writing to Jewish people. He's a Jewish prophet. But he talks about the nations themselves. On that day, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse. They're going to come. He's going to regather them. And to his resting place, which will be glorious. Then verse 11. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover with his hand the second time the remnant of his people who remain. From Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, etc., etc., and from the islands of the sea, and he will lift up a flag for the nations and assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Now I'm going to pause there for a moment. This also, you see this taking place. You know, here's the date. I think I'm going to give you the right date. I have it on my memory here. It was May, I think, 18th. What happened on that date?
Israel was recognized as a nation.
That's the United States was the first nation to recognize post-World War II a homeland for the Jews. Recognize them as being a nation once again. After more than 2,000 years of being scattered throughout the world, what happened next? What happened next was a migration. I think it's the 14th.
No, it's the 18th.
Is it the 18th?
Day before my birthday.
Okay, well, is that how you remember it?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So there became a migration. Jews from everywhere began coming back to Israel. And it's an interesting thing. When you go, that you will see Jewish individuals dressed in various different ways. Our guide, while we were there, said, when you see these Jews walking around with these big fluffy hats, do you know what you're looking at? A Jew with a big fluffy hat. Usually they came from Eastern Europe. Some come from Russia. There were Jews coming that didn't even speak Hebrew. And they reconstituted a nation. And Jews from literally all over the world. And you'll find people that are Jewish from various people groups. I'm not saying that right. With different, you will find African Jews, you will find European Jews, you will find Israeli or Jews from that area, you'll find American Jews, you'll find all kinds that are there now. That's important. That's important because Isaiah said it was going to happen. Through Isaiah, listen to what then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover with his hand a second time a remnant from his people from all these areas. And he will lift up his flag for the nations and assemble the banished ones in Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. He's bringing them back.
He must have believed in a flat earth.
We still say it that way. You know, we describe things. By the way, this is just maybe different, but maybe we got four directions. So it's a custom to say, use as a metaphor, the four corners of the earth, because of four major directions. In addition to that, is speaking phenomenologically, and we still do that. Look at check in the newspaper, check on the weather channel, your app on the phone. It will tell you when the sun will rise in the morning. It will also tell you when the sun is going to set. Both of those are wrong. The sun doesn't rise and it doesn't set.
Yeah.
But we talk that way because that is the way we describe it. So that's what people do. And people have always done that, is describe things as it appears to them. That's just normal. And we still do it. And that's just one example. There are many other examples, and we still do that kind of thing. Okay. Let's go verse 14. Verse 13 first. Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah will be eliminated. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. They will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west, and they will plunder the people of the east. They will possess Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon will be subject to them. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and he will wave his hand over the Euphrates River, he with a scorching wind, and he will strike it into seven streams, and the people walk over in dry sandals. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people, who will be left just as there was in Israel on the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt. Now, coming back to that, there have been those that have noticed that in Iraq, the Euphrates River, that there were other rivers in the ancient world that were there. Some of those have dried. They're no longer rivers, but it's apparent that they were at one time rivers. Even the Euphrates is, according to some, drying up. It is not as massive as it used to be. You take that for what it's worth. I don't want to go too far with that because I haven't done enough research on it to verify some of those things. Other than I saw some photographs, if they were coming from the Euphrates area, that would indicate that indeed it is not the massive river that it once was. And you get that impression here. In other words, there's no hindrance for God's people to return. But the key is the remnant. The remnant. What the remnant means is that even during times of national catastrophe, there still are going to be survivors. Survivors that are going to enable, because of their being survivors, to enable God's plan moving forward. Just think about it. The different historical situations in the ancient world. You begin with Egypt first. 70 people, right at that number, 70 go down into Egypt, and in 400 years there's millions of Jews there. But as the Jews begin to populate, propagate, and grow in numbers, the Pharaoh and probably his advisors became aware of a potential problem. Here are these Jews increasing in number, and if we are attacked by an outside force, what if these Jews join in with that outside threat? You've got an enemy not only without, but now you've got an enemy within. So So what do you remember during the time of the birth of Moses? What was the solution?
Kill the male children.
Kill all the male children. Kill all the male children. To stop a potential army one day of being inside your borders. Well, that's one example. They left, they came out of Egypt. I'm going to fast forward and come to the time of the Assyrians. The Assyrians came down and they conquered the northern kingdom totally. And they conquered some of the cities in the southern kingdom. And they would have conquered Jerusalem except the death angel stepped in. And an angel killed 185,000 Assyrians. Stopped that invasion. So what do you do? Well, then you have another group. You have another empire. This one's going to be bigger. It's going to be even stronger. It's going to be the Babylonian Empire. They're not only going to reconquer the area that the Assyrians controlled, they're actually going to take control of Judah. And they did. They did. In 701 BC, there was a deportation of a lot of the best that was there, the leadership, the young men that could be useful in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And then another one a few years later, and finally in 587 BC, a total conquering of the land of Israel by the Babylonians. Jews were carried off. Some remained in the land, and they intermarried with other people groups that were misplaced into the land. That's where you get, for example, the Samaritans. So it looked like, you know, they're gone. They'll be like all these other people groups in the ancient world. They'll just be absorbed in a new group of people. Like you don't see any Amorites or Perizzites or any of the other ites that you find in the Old Testament era. They're still in existence. They've been absorbed in other groups, totally lost in antiquity. Jews never did. Even though they would be dwindled down to just a fraction of the number of Jews surviving, but they would still have a remnant. God preserved a remnant. And the reason for that is the promises that he made both to Abraham and he made to David. And of course the promise of coming Messiah. The Jews had to survive as a people. So God always saved himself a remnant. Always a remnant. So we have that. And you can even get to the time of the Romans, or the Greeks first, then the Romans. They made life miserable in many respects for the Jewish people, but there was still, the people still existed. And how do you know, how do you keep track of those kind of things? Well, your lineage was very important. And you would memorize your lineage. So you knew, did they know, I mean, when they got all mixed up, did they know which tribe they were from? Yeah. It was Dad's responsibility to make sure Junior memorized his heritage, his ancestors. He had to learn that kind of thing. So they knew. And some argue that the northern kingdoms got all mixed up and lost along the way. Well, interestingly enough, you can find out a great deal from DNA testing these days. And apparently they're using it to know which tribe some of these people are from. And this is an interesting little side note. But God has preserved for himself a remnant.
And that's what we're being reminded of here. Now when we move on, in the future, not next Sunday, not next Wednesday night, because next Wednesday night we're not meeting, right?
Right.
Okay, good. We're going to move on about some of the additional prophecies that are coming, and we'll continue with those, and then we'll get into some historical narrative where Isaiah is once again talking to like Hezekiah and dealing with him and helping him and that kind of thing. So that's kind of where we're going. And then when we get to chapter, kind of the big picture here, when we get into chapter 40 and following, that is like it's almost like a second book, because the historical situation changes, the language changes, the focus changes, and we're going to be meeting on the pages of the latter part of Isaiah the suffering servant songs. Things that, as you look back, are applicable to Jesus, almost descriptive of Jesus. In kind of a closing thought on my part here, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John tell us about Jesus being crucified. Isaiah chapter 53 tells us what it means that he was crucified. That's astounding, and it kind of, it's hard for me to wait, you know, for 3 years to, no, not quite that long, to get to it, that we can actually deal with the servant songs, because you understand, of course, we're post Jesus looking back, we see it very clearly. Matter of fact, Isaiah 53 is called to, by some Jews, the forbidden chapter, because they don't know. The rabbis basically associate it with the nation itself, and that the personification of the nation. But when you read it and just take it, the words for what the words say, you know it's talking about a person, and you get some very vivid details there. We, you know, anyway. Comments or questions? Criticisms? Something.
I say it was amazing that they taught their kids these things, you know, all the way back, you know, and that all the stories from before, you know, most wrote, all had to be handed down.
You know, we think about, you know, both Luke and Matthew writing down the genealogies of Jesus, writing those down. How could he possibly know those? Well, they remember. See what's happened in the ancient world. If information was important, you memorized it. In our day, if information is important, you write it down. Mm-hmm. That's just a difference. I was listening to a fellow named Mark, I don't remember his name. It's not Marcus, it's Mark, something like that, McLaughlin, who has certain chapters or certain books of the Bible memorized. He's an actor, a trained actor. He's really good. And he's got a presentation I have on a DVD about how to memorize, how to remember things. And it's quite interesting, the devices that he talks about using, that kind of thing. But in that talk, he says, to show you how our culture's changed, you know, back in the 18, late 50s, 60s, into the 60s, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Mm-hmm. They may debate for 3 hours. You sit there, you listen for 3 hours. You go home, somebody asks you about there, and you almost tell them word for word what was said. Douglas said this, Lincoln said that. You know, you'd be able to do that because they were trained to do that, because you didn't have, you know, iPads or notebooks or pencils that were available everywhere and something to write on. You just didn't have those things available, so you could memorize and remember. And we've become somewhat opposite of that. We write stuff down. Do you write stuff down? Mm-hmm. If I go to Walmart and don't have a list, I forget what I'm there for. Mm-hmm. I'm told when I leave the house, pick up this, 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 and this. You get beyond four items, I may not make it home with it, because I just don't remember. And so if you want, you know,
if Tara really wants those things, she better write them down. And I better be with a pen so I can mark them off that I've got it, and I've got it, and I've got it. Or otherwise, I'll get home and forget it. Last time I went, I didn't get every item on the list because I had my list, but then she told me a couple of the things that weren't on the list. I didn't write them on the list, so I got to... Did you ever get there and you go, oh, I know there was something else.
Yeah.
I know there was.
You actually have to be sure again.
Just keep going. Maybe you'll just by luck hit it, you know.
But you might want to get something you want, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That takes pride.
They don't have guns in there anymore. So. Okay. Any comments or questions? Observations? I hope you can see the relevance of this 8th century BC prophet has so much to say about what was going to happen. So vividly was he giving his prophecies about who was coming. And he's going to talk to us about this person. Like today, the branch, the stem growing from the roots of Jesse. Of, you know, and it had to be. It had to be that way. Because God told us it was going to be that way. It had to be a descendant of David. It had to be. And David had to be a descendant of Judah. It had to be. Because God said that's what it was going, what it was going to be. All right, are we all on the same page there?